our booking agent would just say, you're going to the Alvin Theater. And some of us later knew that it had been a Schubert.
So I actually worked at the Schubert quite a bit. It wasn't a Schubert then. Nobody even heard of that name then. It was the Academy Theater.
And was looking for input as to which theater might be the best for dance. And people were voting for the Schubert at that time. Later on, there was the E-block development and the threat to tear the Schubert down.
I love historic buildings. I like the idea of taking an older building and finding a contemporary use that honors its past. And if you walk down Hennepin Avenue or drive past it and you look at the front of the original Schubert Theater now that it's been restored, it's really beautiful.
The early 20th century was a time of expansion in American theater. Three brothers, Levi, Samuel, and Jacob Schubert, challenged the theatrical syndicate by building more than 60 theaters around the country. The Schubert brothers built two theaters in the Twin Cities, one in downtown St. Paul, now the Fitzgerald Theater, and one in downtown Minneapolis. The Sam S. Schubert Theater of Minneapolis is now an historic landmark. In its early years, lighting up the Schubert's marquee included headliners such as Mae West, the Marx Brothers, Fanny Bryce, and Sarah Bernhardt, along with other vaudeville and burlesque performers. In 1999, it was decided that the Schubert Theater should be moved and renovated. The challenges of moving and renovating the Schubert Theater have been enormous. ArtSpace has taken on the challenge of moving and renovating the Schubert Theater. Roy Close, who works with ArtSpace, has done extensive research on the Schubert Theater. He talks about some of his research findings.
The Schubert in Minneapolis opened on August 29, 1910, and it was designed as a Broadway roadhouse. The Schubert brothers in New York were expanding their empire as rapidly as they could and building theaters all over the country, and this was one of them. And so the intent was that this would be a place where Broadway shows on tour would come. And then during the summertime, when the tours basically dried up, they decided to have a summer stock theater company there. And they hired a theater manager from St. Paul named Buzz Bainbridge to manage the theater and be in charge of the stock company. And the company was so successful, the Bainbridge Players, that it became a full-time operation. We're talking about a show a week. It had its own resident company. It had a repertoire of mostly comedies, but they did some serious work as well. Every now and then they'd take a break, and every now and then there was a big movie that came in because it had an orchestra pit. So in those days, the silent movies could be done. But mostly it was stock. It was a show a week, and so the actors in the company would be performing one show. They would be rehearsing the next week's show, and they would be learning the lines for the show for the following week. So it was really quite an enterprise. And this was, of course, long before the Guthrie, but it was the Guthrie of its day. This was the theater that people went to, and it was before television and before radio. So it was a central location for culture in Minneapolis.
My heart is aflame.
The Bainbridge Players went until the early 30s. I think it must have been 1933. And by that time, the talkies had come in and radio had come in a little bit. And so the theater was kind of losing its audience. And so Buzz Bainbridge closed down the company and ran for mayor and won. So we had a guy going from entertainment to politics. So Buzz Bainbridge was mayor of Minneapolis. He had the misfortune of being mayor during the Teamster strike, and he was a fairly conservative Republican, and so he became very unpopular very quickly and was not reelected.
In 1935, the Schubert was purchased by William Elvin Steffes, who remodeled it and renamed it the Elvin Theater after his own middle name.
In They replaced the original marquee. There was a canopy over the main street. All of that original stuff was replaced in the 30s. And then there was a fire around 1940. And so the theater was closed again and it got new seats again. It did some movies. It did some plays. In about 1940, overnight, it became a burlesque house. And it was a burlesque house into the early 50s. At that time, there was an established burlesque circuit.
Dudley Riggs, founder of the Brave New Workshop and the Experimental Theater Company, has worked in show business since the age of five. He recalls his experiences performing in the Schubert Theater during its time as the Alvin Theater.
Well, this is Dudley Riggs. I've been performing for a number of years. I started out as a kid performer since 1937. And by the time we got into the 50s, my family was usually performing in the circus during the usual circus season and going indoors in the fall into vaudeville theaters or into burlesque theaters or sometimes nightclubs. The policy at that time was a kind of a burlesque vaudeville policy using primarily touring groups of performers, which included sometimes the variety acts of which while I was performing. So I was doing a little juggling and patter. The thing that struck me about the Schubert, I never knew it to be the Schubert, actually. It was always the Alvin, so far as we were concerned. They had the name they were booking. So our booking agent would just say, you're going to the Alvin Theater. And some of us later knew that it had been a Schubert. And of course, in the beginning, the Schubert organization had set that up as a vaudeville theater, so it was purposely set up that way.
It became the Minneapolis Evangelical Auditorium. It had a resident minister, and Oral Roberts was the guest preacher.
Sister Fern Olson started the Evangelistic Auditorium in the Alvin Theater building very shortly after we performed there. I believe that the week we performed may have been the last week that the Alvin had maintained a burlesque policy. Since we were a traveling troupe, we left town and wasn't sure exactly how much longer the theater continued, but the rumor was that it was closing. And then I heard shortly thereafter that the church had taken over the space. And then on subsequent visits to Minneapolis, the large Jesus figure was on the front of the building where the Alvin sign had originally.
As the cinema industry grew and talkies came in, many performing theaters changed over to the new industry. Ted Mann bought many theaters in the downtown Minneapolis area. In 1957, he purchased the Schubert and renamed it the Academy.
But Around the World in 80 Days had its world premiere here because Mike Todd, who had directed and I think produced it, was from North Minneapolis and had actually worked in the theater as a candy butcher selling candy in the aisles when he was a kid. And so there was this very interesting historical connection.
Minneapolis author Bill Burleson is currently writing a fiction novel, Avenue of the Lost and Found. It takes place in the Block E area where the Schubert was first erected. Bill lived in the downtown Minneapolis area in the 1970s. He worked at the Schubert when it was the Academy Theater.
My name is Bill Burleson, and I got a job right after high school in 1977. It was probably about as ambitious as I was when I was 18 years old. I worked at the World Theater, which was next door to the Schubert. It had the same manager and the same management team, so I actually worked at the Schubert quite a bit. It wasn't the Schubert then. Nobody even heard of that name then. It was the Academy Theater. By 1977, it was in terrible condition. It was a really run-down building in every way that you can imagine a building being run down. But it was a fun place. I mean, the carpeting would be all worn out. You could see the tracks where people had been walking for so many years. And they had a janitor there. Both of them had really colorful janitors. and a janitor at the Academy Theater. I mean, I don't know what he did. They had these overnight janitors, and they'd stay in, get locked in the theater, and then let them out in the morning. And this guy didn't clean anything, and people would slip on the carpeting in the auditorium and fall, because it was like this layer of slime from Coke and popcorn and stuff that never got policed up. And nobody cared, because you know what? It was the Academy, okay? Nobody cared. It was in terrible shape.
The architect for the Schubert Theater was William Albert Swayze. Over the years, the Schubert Theater's main facade has been maintained. It is a Beaux-Arts design composed of glazed terracotta with a granite base. But the interior has gone through considerable changes.
It had two balconies. The main floor was fairly flat, a gentle rake, and wooden seats. The first time it was remodeled was in 1918 during the flu epidemic. It was about 8 years old. So by that time, it had certainly had a shakedown run, and it had been heavily used for 8 years. So they came in and they repainted it and did a lot of work there.
They had done remodeling at some point in time because the original theater had two balconies, much like the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. In fact, I believe it was like the same architect and very much the same design, double second balcony on top that makes you fear for your life when you're getting into seats because of the angle and how you're hanging off the ceiling like that. And that was the case here. It had two balconies, but it had been long closed, and they built a candy counter in front of it and blocked it off permanently. So you had to be an employee to get anywhere near this thing, and you had to know how to get there. And it was actually a door behind the candy stand to get up to the second balcony. So we'd go up there all the time.
What I liked about was the fact that the two-balcony house, as I recall, and there were boxes on both sides. And it was possible then for a performer to relate closely to the people who were seated in the near stage boxes. So those second levels came down, second level boxes near the front were so close it was possible, in my case, to bounce a ball. It would go up and land in the landing box and then be thrown back. But I remember the theater seemed to have almost no lobby, and that was kind of a problem for crowd control and so forth. My dressing room was up on about the third floor and opened onto a fire escape, and so I didn't have exactly a star billing dressing room. All of those were taken by the lovely ladies who were on the first floor.
And Ted Mann did a complete remodeling, made it into a movie theater big enough to accommodate a wide, curving screen. That's when the royal boxes on both sides of the theater were removed.
It was an interesting building in that it was a theater at one time. So if you were into exploring at all, and God knows I was, if you went exploring, you go down to the basement, and you could see the lifts for like lifting platforms up from the basement. So like props and things can come up out of the basement. It's all there. All that stuff's there. You go backstage and there were dressing rooms. There was one dressing room especially, not too far off the stage, where behind the screen on the stage, you could walk right behind the screen and see the backside of the movie playing. And you walked into a room and it had a star on the door and a woman's name. And we went in there. We always assumed it was a stripper from when it was more of a burlesque house. And as you went up the side of the auditorium, there were all these rooms, all these little catacombs of rooms all along the, would be the northwest side of the building. And you could like go up this endless staircase up the side of this huge building, really. And you can see how tall it is now. Go up this staircase, all these rooms, and there'd be like several rooms had old movies laying in them, cans of movies just laying there. I have no idea what the movies were or what happened to them. And you'd go up through these rooms, and if you get right up in the top, right short of the ceiling, you could get out on this catwalk that ran, you know, about 6 feet from the very top corner of the ceiling, way up above the screen, way down many floors below you. And the catwalk was barely hanging on the wall, hanging off at about a 45-degree angle. So you had to walk out there and look off over the side and then come back.
By the early 1980s, downtown Minneapolis was ceasing to be a destination for moviegoers. Ted Mann closed the Academy in 1983. 3 years later, the building became the city's property. With the help of the State Historic Preservation Office and the Minneapolis Heritage Preservation Commission, a plan was formed to save the building. The Schubert Theater sat vacant for 16 years until it was finally moved in February 1999. John Linderson works at the Hennepin Center for the Arts. He has participated in the saving of the Schubert and been preparing the Hennepin Center for the Arts for the new Schubert edition.
Somewhere in the 90s, Kelly Lindquist of ArtSpace gave the dance community a tour through the Schubert and through the Pantages Theater and was looking for input as to which theater might be the best for dance. And people were voting for the Schubert at that time. Later on, there was the E-block development and the threat to tear the Schubert down. I participated in some of the petitioning there, spending some time out in front with union workers and other people who are interested in saving the Schubert.
The renovation idea came up, I think, around the beginning of 1998 or 97. It was sort of a casual conversation between some folks who worked at ArtSpace and a couple of city council members. It led to the notion that the city council would give the theater to ArtSpace and allocate some money to move it off Block E. Because at that time, the city had committed to providing a clear Block E for Brookfield Development, which ultimately built the development that stands there now. At the same time, the Schubert had gone on the National Register of Historic Places, and there was some concern that there might be a lawsuit to prevent it from being torn down. The city felt that probably the best compromise was to move the building off Block E, and when the suggestion came along to move it over next to Hennepin Center for the Arts, it seemed like a great idea. So that's what happened. The building was moved in February of 1999. And before it was moved, ArtSpace did a number of studies, 8 or 9, about things like, would there be a use for the theater if we moved it? Could you raise funds to pay for it? How much would it cost? They brought in, you know, a number of consultants and did various kinds of studies. And the conclusion was, yes, it could be done. And ArtSpace, which has long had a reputation of taking on projects that other people are not willing to do, went ahead and did it. And so then I came aboard in 1999 with a couple of other people, my boss at the time, Wendy Holmes, and with the mandate to figure out a way to get it done.
Stubbs Building and House Movers, in cooperation with Expert House Movers of Maryland and International Chimney Corporation of Buffalo, New York, worked through the sub-zero temperatures in the winter of 1999 to move the historic Schubert Theater. The move system consisted of a grid of steel beams installed underneath the theater and a massive interior truss system designed to control deflection. Once the steel was in place, the theater was lifted with unified hydraulics to its moving height. Then 70 rubber-tired dollies, each the size of a small car, were installed. A 3-zone hydraulic system was used to keep the building on the same plane as it was being moved to its new home. The Schubert Theater is now registered in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most massive building ever moved on rubber-wheeled dollies. When moved, the theater weighed 2,908 tons and had a mass that was equivalent to moving 75 three-bedroom homes.
It took a while to prepare the site and prepare the building for moving, and there came the day that they were going to lift it. They call it cracking, and using hydraulic, they lift it straight up. But then they did an interesting thing. When they move it, when they roll it on the wheels, they set it up on a tripod kind of thing, like a three-legged stool. So as you go over uneven ground, it doesn't put any twisting torque on the structure, and it moved with no significant damage, nothing at all, really, that I know of.
The Schubert Theater was moved from 7th Street onto Hennepin Avenue between 5th Street and 6th Street. Once the move was complete, the Schubert sat for 10 years while funds were being raised for renovation. Ground was broken in November 2009 to begin the preparation and renovation of the Schubert Theater. The Schubert Theater will be included in a new three-building complex with the historic Hennepin Center for the Arts and a new atrium building that will connect the two historic buildings.
Hennepin Center for the Arts was built in the 1880s. Construction began in 1888 and it was completed in 1890, and it was the home of a number of Masonic lodges.
When we first came here in 79, the Masons still were here on 6th floor and 5th floor. The studio in 6 was a blue room. It was the main lodge of the building, the biggest one. The first floor had a Kenny Shoe store, a small lobby for the upper floors, a church, and a liquor store. On the 8th floor, where the illusion is now, there was a drop low ceiling, and it had Eagles Lodge were playing bingo.
Next door to Hennepin Center, on the Hennepin side, basically right where the atrium building is going in now, was a tiny theater called the Unique Theater. Very small. What I know about it is that Charlie Chaplin performed there in his younger days. Next door to that, on the corner of 5th and Hennepin, was a magnificent hotel called the West Hotel, which was also built in the 1880s and was just glorious. It was really a wonderful building and a luxury hotel and the best hotel in Minneapolis for a number of years. What happened to the West Hotel was that they had a fire, which didn't destroy the hotel, but caused it to lose its cachet, and it lost business, and it was torn down in 1940. And that lot has been vacant ever since, been a parking lot ever since.
And I must say, even watching right now, it's amazing what the construction industry can really do with very difficult projects. They really have an expertise at making large, impossible projects happen.
And one of the interesting things about the Schubert project is that during the construction this past summer, we accidentally came across an unmarked well that had belonged to the West Hotel and was 625 feet deep or something, and had to be filled in and plugged. Also, we encountered quite a bit of debris in the atrium site, which might well have been from the Unique Theater. Whenever you're dealing with old buildings or spots where old buildings have been, you run this risk. The 1910 theater, in those days, theaters were not built as destinations for any kind of social activity other than attending a performance of the theater. So they had small lobbies. They had maybe a small concession booth and a small ticket office, tiny. Notions of customer service and of what going to the theater means have changed over the decades, and that lobby space has become an important amenity for theaters. So there's no way to recreate that space in the Schubert Theater lobby, which was a tiny lobby. You weren't expected to stay there and have a drink. You were expected to go through the lobby and get to your seat. In order to create a welcoming amenity lobby with a large box office, with plenty of space to hang coats and a sufficient number of restrooms, it was pretty clear that we needed to have some kind of an additional structure. The obvious space for that was between the two historic buildings. An atrium, a grand lobby, a kind of nerve center for the building. That's where the ticket office will be. The whole idea of this thing from the beginning was that the real need in the Twin Cities is for a mid-sized venue that focuses on dance. So during the process of figuring out how to make it work best for dance, a decision was made to do away first with the upper balcony and then with the lower balcony. So on the inside, it will not be historic in that sense. It will have a more steeply raked main floor. There will be a wall, and then above that, at the level of the original first balcony, will be a single balcony that will go back, and the total seating capacity will be about 500, which is a third of what the Schubert Theater was when it opened in 1910.
The renovated building will have a 100-foot-tall stage house, a new structure housing the stage and fly areas. It will also have an orchestra pit big enough for up to 42 musicians, and none of the theater's 500 seats is more than 65 feet from the stage.
We're going to restore the canopy over the main entrance of the theater building, and something close to the original marquee that said Schubert.
The Schubert Theater has been renamed the Goodale Theater in honor of Catherine and Robert Goodale, who were early contributors to the project. The Minnesota Schubert Center for Performing Arts has been renamed the Cole Center for Dance and the Performing Arts in recognition of Sage and John Cole's lifelong commitment to the arts and their reputation for being passionate champions of dance.
There are, of course, been many theaters in downtown Minneapolis, and Schubert was one of the last ones to try to save. The city's been quite good at saving the other theaters on Hennepin Avenue. And I was beginning to think the only problem with the Schubert was that it wasn't on Hennepin Avenue. And lo and behold, Tom Nordyke came up with this crazy idea to move it on Hennepin Avenue, right next to the Hennepin Center for the Arts.
If you didn't have a job on New Year's Eve, you probably weren't in show business.
The Schubert Theater is now over 100 years old. Its new incarnation as the Goodale Theater and being part of the new Cole Center for Dance and the Performing Arts is slated to open on September 9th, 2011. Voices heard on the Schubert Theater of Minneapolis: Dixie Treichel, Roy Close, Dudley Riggs, Bill Burleson, and John Linnerson. This is Dixie Treichel for KFAI.
Mini Culture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.